Very good evening, once again, and welcome to the Lady Mitchell Hall. Welcome to the talk on befriending inner fear. And this is organized by Cambridge University Buddhist Society. I thank all of you for coming really on time. And me and my team were joking a bit, we're saying that probably the people sitting all the way at the front are not from Cambridge University, because students in Cambridge always come 5 minutes after lecture starts. So, well done everyone. So, my name is Peng Shen, and I am the chairperson of the Cambridge University Buddhist Society. And I would like to invite our senior treasurer, Rachel Harris, to actually be the MC for tonight. Rachel, please.
A very warm welcome to all of you on behalf of the University Buddhist Society. The Society is taking the time to make Buddhism more accessible, more available to anybody. And when I say everybody, from people who've been Buddhists from the day they were born, to people who've become Buddhists sometime in their adult life, to people who are definitely not Buddhists, but see in Buddhist practices, in Buddhist ideas, or some Buddhist practices in Buddhist ideas, something that can be helpful to them, something that's worthy of investigation. And the Society welcomes orthodox, different groups of people, anybody in between. So it's a great delight, actually, to see people from across the whole range of interests and engagements with Buddhism here. And just to actually know that wherever we come from, wherever we stand, we all share that kind of interest. So it's wonderful, as we're wondering around the evening, I said before. Might be very good to go up to somebody you don't know and just ask them about their interest in Buddhism. When I say that the Society is for making Buddhism accessible and available to people, I don't just mean in terms of theory, of conveying Buddhist ideas. I mean in terms also of trying to enable people to see how it can be very directly relevant to them, in terms of how they live their lives, in terms of practices they may wish to do, in terms of the way they think about how they're living their lives. In that sense, I can't think of anybody better suited to give a talk than Ajahn Brahm, who, on the one hand, has profound meditation experiences, and on the other, he's very much in contact with, you know, as ordinary folks and how we live our lives. He wasn't himself a student at Cambridge University. He was a member. A committed member of the University of Buddhist Society. Which might be pleased to know that he also started his meditation career in a meditation group here. Connected with the University of Buddhist Society. So he knows something of what this place is about. And I think the title of the talk, the Friends of Inner Fear, shows he actually knows a lot about it. He's here in Britain in support of a project which you have a major role in providing a place of support in the country for polio-free Buddhist nuns. The Gevermore Chandra is here to to have together with the practice of other women. It was worked for us promotion. And any donations that are made tonight will go to that. Finally, I'd like to say a very great thanks to the current members of the University Cultural Society Committee for organising all this so efficiently. Let's hope that they all, in due course, end up here at Chandra. Thank you.
Okay, I'll take over now. So, I love coming to Cambridge because this is a place where I grew up. And that meditation retreat was in Baden Road. You know Baden Road? A couple of boarding houses in those days, and a beautiful retreat there. And even this Lady Mitchell Hall, I was just checking, and it is the same hall where I first appeared on TV nationally. And the reason why this was, I think, roughly about 1971, being a student in the 60s and 70s, there was one thing which was part of your student career in those days, demonstrations. And all the other universities in the UK had demos, and I felt so deprived that Cambridge University was so stuffy that we couldn't have any demonstrations until that year, I believe it was the economics faculty decided to change their means of assessment from the FIPOS, that's the end of the year examinations, to a continuous assessment. And the University of Colleges blocked it, and that was our chance to demonstrate. And we held our meeting in this very hall a long time ago, and as I walked into the hall, because the demonstration in Cambridge was newsworthy in those days, the BBC were outside of their campus. And it was amazing, a couple of hundred students, came to the meeting. I was only one of them, but because in those days, I had much longer hair. I had a beard. And I looked the archetypal leftist student. So it was me. The BBC show on the evening news. And my goodness, I called hell for my family the following day. We saw you on the news last night. What are you doing? Get back to your studies. Get back to your lectures. So that was my first introduction to fame. But anyhow, it's great to be back here and great for you to come and support this. Actually, this is a talk, but later on we'll talk about it. This recruiting project. So first of all, I was asked to do a 10-minute meditation, first of all. Now the reason we do a 10-minute meditation, any psychologist knows that when I get you very calm and quiet, then I can brainwash you and beautiful with you far greater effect. So my people will have more influence over you. So, if you've never meditated before, it was quite a beginner's mind. Those who meditate a lot, don't mind forget about anything you've ever been taught. Because the essence of meditation is just being here. There are many different types of meditation, and they all sort of support each other. You look at the same thing from different angles. So the one I'm going to teach today is based on a story in one of my books, The Emperor's Three Questions, Meditation. This was a book by Leo Tolstoy, which I read here at Cambridge as a young student, where the emperor wanted to find his own religion, ended up by discovering there's only three things you need to know the answers for. When is the most important time? Who is the most important person? What is the most important thing to do? And after a long story, he found the answers. Now is the most important time, as you all know. Who is the most important person? This is the one which maybe sees things very differently. The most important person is the one right in front of you, whoever they happen to be. Have you ever, if any students here, have you ever gone to a lecturer after a lecture, ask them a question, and they're not listening, they want to get rid of you? You are a student. That happened to me so many times. I was a famous student. And that sucks. So, whoever's in front of you is the most important person in the world. What's the most important thing to do? to find this better on this problem. The most important thing is not to change things, it's to care for things. The most important thing for you is to care. The most important person is the one in front of you. The most important time is now. Now, what that's got to do with meditation is, for goodness sake, stop choosing what you're going to be aware of. Stop just washing the breath, sweeping the body, washing this, washing that. What is in front of your mind right now? That is the most important meditation object in the world. Now is the only time you ever have. So what should you do with what you are aware of right now? Just care for it. Don't try and change it. Don't develop it. Don't get rid of it. Don't make it anything different. Care for it. Now is the most important time. Whatever's in front of you, you're sleeping, you're tired, you're restless, you're thinking about something, don't get rid of it. Care for it. And see what happens. That's such an easy thing to do, and highly effective. Simplified meditation to the max. Okay? So, you just got 10 minutes, go down and cross your eyes. Only 8 minutes. With your eyes closed. Now, most important time. Now, where your future has been made. This is the only time you have. This, as a baby, is the most important. The sound of the baby is the most important thing in the world. Just be with that sound. Careful. Any time the sound doesn't disturb you. If it is, don't disturb the sound. Be emotional, be careful, be careful. And find your mind to be peaceful. Giving it importance while you're trying to get rid of it. Are you caring for this moment? Respecting it. Letting whatever you're aware of right now be. Or are you trying to get something?
how do you feel right now? Come to the end of this very short meditation. If you didn't find that in my life, to give it pause and care for it, you know, become peaceful. Become still. The mindfulness increases. The inner stillness, the beautiful happiness, and peace. Please now open your eyes. Oh, good. Another alumni from Cambridge University Buddhist Society sitting in the back. My good friend, Professor Bernard Carr from London. He comes to front of you like a snack. But anyway, so he's going to work. How many of those orchids did we get through that? What happened? Good. Lady is trying to get into what he's paying for. Anyway, he's a good friend. And that's what he says. Anyway, you're a trader working, Vernon.
Many years ago.
Many years ago, yes. The alumni of the most famous Buddhist society in the world, Cambridge Buddhist Society. But anyway, the acronym that Thomas spoke to me about, confronting, or rather not confronting, that's the man for this work, befriending. So the inner fear. As you know, it's supposed to be the most fearful thing you can do is to give public thoughts. And this is what I am now doing. And do I look at my... What's happening?
What is it? Somebody's fine.
So, I often thought, when I started giving public talks, there was only two possible outcomes. The first outcome was that people hate my talks. They walk out. They think it's terrible. But I cannot connect. And I'm no good as a teacher. And I thought, wonderful, magnificent, that I can sit at the back like everybody else and just enjoy myself. I can be peaceful. I can be a hermit. I can just take it easy. And if people like my talks, if they come in great numbers, and they invite me to go all over the place, marvellous, wonderful. It means that I can inspire other people and help them. That gives me so much happiness. For me, the two outcomes were equally positive, which means I didn't give a damn whether it was good talk or not. I could be free of fear. And that's one of the wonderful things, to overcome fear. It doesn't matter which way you go. Both ways, you win. If you know how to look at the future, win. A positive mind. Which is how fear is actually defeated, and it never controls you ever again. Of course, coming here to Cambridge in those days, it actually was much lighter workload than today. So we had enormous opportunity in not just to go to the lectures in your particular subject, but to explore other lectures as well. And I went to architecture lectures, philosophy lectures, and actually I loved philosophy when I was here. And in fact, I learned this story from one of the most famous English philosophers. I don't know if you know, I think everyone knows this philosopher. He is so famous. His name was Winnie the Pooh. Otherwise known as Pooh Bear. And he made known the story that Winnie the Pooh had a little friend, Piglet. And Piglet, small people, are usually very afraid. You can understand why, because they're so vulnerable in this big world. So one day, Winnie the Pooh and his best friend, Piglet, were walking back from Rabbit's house, where they had a little something, as they used to say. If you don't read the poem. And walking back, they were walking through the forest when a storm started to arise. And they were still a long way from home. And as they were walking still a long way from home, the storm got fiercer and stronger. At first,
twigs came down. And after the twigs, branches came down. And after the branches, whole trees came down around them. It was dangerous. Still a long way to go. And little Piglet got more and more afraid. And help! His old Piglet and his best friend Winnie the Pooh. What would happen to us if a tree fell when we were underneath it? Now, usually I'm not allowed to get excited, but when I get caught, I have three reins to show you my acting skills, my dramatic persona, which has been frustrated by years of being a monkey. But now, I let go of my interference and play it out. So he was very afraid. And what you do is he squeezes the poop edge on really tight in his face. And for one second, only one second only, Winnie the Pooh was afraid. It wasn't a real possibility. It was a storm. And trees do come down. And they have a long way to go through the forest. But then, the great wisdom of the best British philosopher ever, Winnie the Pooh, came up. And he said, yes. What would happen if the trees fell when we were underneath it? And that little change of emphasis was what overcame both of their fear. Fear is one in followed by something negative. And the opposite is one in followed by something positive. And the ultimate of what would happen if a tree had fell, which was far more likely. And so they could continue their journey perfectly happy, perfectly safe, and to get home. And that's a philosophy I learned from Winnie the Pooh, which was so Buddhist. So, a lot of fear is an expression of our negativity to the world, thinking what would happen if it all goes wrong. And you may notice that that particular thought would actually make things go wrong more likely. Now in my life I get to do some very interesting gigs. And one of those was last year in my hometown in Australia, of Perth, Western Australia, where the government were putting a lot of money in for cancer care. And there was this huge complex, a campus, for getting all the cancer groups, the Melanoma Society, the Skin Cancer Society, Prostate Cancer Society, all in one campus. And the Premier of the State of Western Australia, the head of the government then, which invited him to open it, together with a young man. And I got to sprinkle the Premier with holy water, which I enjoyed immensely. I don't know what he thought about it. But anyway, I asked why hadn't you invited anyone of any other religion? And they said, because, Ajahn, you've been looking after us for 26 years. That's when I first went there. Going every year to teach a little bit of meditation, positive psychology, Buddhism, to people who had cancer. And I said, but yeah, other people come. Why me? And then they said that when I first came, there was one woman who had breast cancer, had gone through the treatment, and was in remission. A very unpleasant treatment, a long time of suffering, but she got through remission. But she still had inner fear. Her fear was, what happens if it comes back? And that was crippling her life. Psychiatrists were unable to help her. And this weird guy in a brown robe and bald head comes along. And when she asked me that question, I said, no, you asked me, what would happen if your cancer comes back? The answer is, what would happen if it doesn't? And she got it straight away. And she said, from that time on, she stopped worrying about the cancer coming back. It didn't come back. She comes back every year when I visit, 26 years. So for people like that, that's why we invited you back. Because not just the people who you back to help. And this, you see, that gives the story of why that works. If you keep worrying, what would happen if it comes back? What would happen if it comes back? What would happen if it comes back? That gives you so much stress, so much negativity, so much fear, that gives a cause of that inner stress. You won't be able to relax, enjoy your life, which means it's more likely to come back. So basically, I'll stop you coming back for that. And this is one of the great reasons why. If you understand what fear is, whatever you're afraid of, then what will you do? If you overcome that fear, it's less likely to happen. Now the other thing, the other little story which I like to tell about inner fear, I learned this from a TV, it's been a long time, I think about 42 years now, it's been a long time since I was able to watch TV. And this TV program, many of you my age may remember it, it was the only thing which was close to Buddhism on the TV, Kung Fu. Starring Grasshopper and his blind master. Remember that one? Yeah, now, somebody said, one of my friends said, if that is Buddhism, why is it always so violent every week? Yeah. And there's one particular episode which again interests me. This little grasshopper, he was a little novice learning about Dhamma. Not in lectures, but by exercises. And so one day his blind master took him into this very spooky room in the back of the monastery. It was usually off limits for everybody except the very senior monks. And he opened the door into this room, and when he walked little grasshopper into this dark room, gave him time for his eyes to adjust to the very, very limited light. He asked grasshopper, "What do you see, grasshopper? What do you see?" And grasshopper replied, "I can see like a swimming pool." And of course, I was watching the TV, and that's what I saw, it was swimming pool. And he said, "Go close, what do you see in the bottom of that pool, little grasshopper?" And I saw the TV screen. "Bones, master. I see human bones." "Don't go any closer, grasshopper, because that is not water. That is concentrated acid." And I got scared. They're movies on TV. They're totally false, but you get drawn into them. It's an amazing phenomenon. And I've seen this myself. Why, say, a soccer match. I've gone past the airport and saw the big screen, and the soccer match was being played. It's like I usually go to Singapore Airlines when I travel from Australia to England. And in Changi Airport, there's big screens, and I've seen people there. There's a fellow like Liverpool, and playing Manchester United, and they're shouting at that screen, "Offside, Red! Offside!" It doesn't matter how loud you shout in Singapore. They cannot hear you in Happy and Liverpool. It's also a replay anyway. But why do people shout at the screen? I remember here when I was a student, every year we would have cheap movies. I remember one of the movies I saw here was Tarantula. And this was, 42 years ago, special effects were nothing in those days. It was totally fake. You could see it was fake, but never mind. You enjoyed the movie. And Tarantula was a spider who was involved in a nuclear accident and became about 10 times the size of a normal tarantula and would always go after people and kill them. But apparently this is the same in movies today. My sources tell me. Tarantulas, or these days, vampires and zombies, they only go after and kill beautiful young women. If you're old and ugly, you are safe. Check the movie, it's true. So there was Tarantula going after this beautiful young woman. And someone in the audience, they shouted out, "Look behind you, Tarantula is coming."
Hey, Grandma, what are you shouting at the movie for? They can't hear you. It's a movie.
But you know, we always get drawn in. And the psychology is very fascinating. The reason why we do this in a football match and a movie is because we literally, our mind gets sucked into that screen. And we think that we're in the battle. We think that we're actually at the football stadium. That's what our mind feels, which is why we shout, because we really feel they can hear us. It's the psychology of being sucked in to a movie, to a football match, to a fantasy in your mind, or even to just a thought pattern. You get sucked in, it's real, because you've got no perspective. That is one of the problems there. But anyway, I feel sucked in to this TV show. I too was getting a bit scared. Grasshopper, it's dangerous. What else do you see? A plant. I see a plant going from one end of the pool to the other over the acid. Correct, Grasshopper. In 1 week's time, you will face a very difficult and dangerous test. You will have to walk across that plank over the acid. And if you fall, you will join the thousands of other little novices like you who did not make it. And I was terrified. I was in Acton, London, what you missed. I was scared. But it took him outside that terrible room, said, we give you 7 days of practice. No chanting, no meditation, no other ceremonies or work. I just want you to practice. And here's the plan. The same size, the same length, and the temple courtyard with just on 2 bricks. The practice. So the 7 days, little class on the practice, go backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. He could do it blindfolded. He could do it backwards. But when it came to the test, after 7 days, when they took him into that dark room with the plank over acid, you can understand that the plank, the same size and length over acid, is much narrower and longer for one over the temple courtyard. And so when the master said, go to the end of the plank, little grasshopper did what? Get on the plank, little grasshopper. Little grasshopper looked back at the master. He could read his expression.
Please, no, don't make me.
Whoa! Commanded the master. So little grasshopper had to walk along the plank across the concentrated acid. And as he walked, you could see his knees start to shake. As he got a third of the way across, you saw him start to wobble. As he got halfway across, he started to sway. A little bit further, he looked like he was going to fall in. And that's when they stopped for the commercials.
I remember that. They still do that. Disgusting. This was important. I didn't really need to know what soap powder to buy. I would have found out what was happening to the grasshopper.
You could have to wait eternally for this stupid advert to finish. Then we'll back again. A little grasshopper. Always keep going up a few seconds back from where you were. Little grasshopper starts to wobble. And he started to sway. He swayed even more. It looked like he was going to fall in.
And he did fall in. And the grasshopper fell into the pool of burning acid and was splashing around there.
And his compassionate master was laughing his head off. I thought, what a goodest thing to do, to laugh and not try and save a disciple who's burning in acid. And then I realized at the same time as the little grasshopper, it wasn't burning. That's why the master was laughing. He said, don't worry, little grasshopper. It's not acid, it's only water. He threw the bones down there for special effects. To convince you of that. And then came the teaching. What pushed you in, little grasshopper? Why did you fall? Fear pushed you in, little grasshopper. Only fear. And I got that, as hopefully you get that. You're doing an examination here in Cambridge. Why do you fail? Fear made you fail. Little student, only fear, nothing else.
interfere when we're afraid of getting like a cancer, like a virus. His fear makes us get that virus. Nothing else. The nature of the mind is powerful. What we are afraid of, which usually we make it more possible that happens. So which is one of the reasons why fear pushes you in, makes you fail far too often. That's why it is our biggest problem. So, how do we overcome that inner fear? It's not overcoming it. So, right language. If you try and overcome that fear, it just gets stronger and stronger and stronger. I will not be afraid. I will not be afraid. That's lying to yourself. So instead, there's so many other beautiful ways of overcoming. Not overcoming, but get to that same place where the fear is just leaves you without fighting it. And that is with things like befriending it, embracing it, allowing it to be instead of trying to get rid of it, caring for it instead of trying to cure it. Now that particular story I mentioned in the talk last night is origin and the consequences of a story like that. And this was a doctor. Now in a temple, a Buddhist temple, it's not just teaching meditation, it's not just giving talks. It's actually doing the whole caring, the personal service for people as well. Looking after people when they're in problems and trouble. Looking after them when they're giving birth beforehand, giving them a boost of goodwill and energy, even though they're trying to give them some chanting or whatever it's holy water or whatever, just in order to lift up their spirits, to encourage them. And when they're young, any problems, when they get married, they do the marriage service for them, teaching them all the tricks about how to have a happy marriage. Have you ever noticed, I think the same in England, when you get married, you get a priest who's usually celibate, who's never been married. Why do you do that? They don't know what they're talking about, do they? But I still get invited, because actually we do know what we are talking about. Any of you here have got a relationship? What breaks up relationships? Arguments. And especially here in this university where many of you are highly educated. So in a relationship, you have an argument. Forget trying to convince your partner that they are wrong. Even if you've got a PhD in law and you're the head of the debating society of Cambridge Union, you may be able to debate with a judge about whether someone's innocent or not and actually convince them. You will never win with a wife or with a husband. No way. If you're Theresa May, the Prime Minister, I'm sure she cannot convince her husband he's wrong. Not even Margaret Thatcher could do that. It's a waste of time trying to have an argument and prove the other person is wrong. So there's another way, a Buddha's way, of actually solving arguments in marriages and relationships. It's called the calendar method. Now, first of all, the reason why this works is that sometimes giving in to your partner, that's intolerable. Why should I always be the one who gives in? And sometimes it works like, this is so demeaning. Why do you always have to be right? So you can't always be right, you can't always be wrong. The secret of a relationship is sharing, making it fair. So how can we do this? It's very simple. It's called the calendar method. If you have an argument with your partner, don't try and prove they're wrong and you're right. Look at the date. What day of the month is it? And if it's an odd day of the month, 1st, 3rd, 5th, 7th, 9th, so on, the woman is always right. Even though the month, second, fourth, sixth, and so forth, the man is always right. So don't have to have an argument. The calendar settles it for you. And it's fair.
So it's so one of the problems in the life, the Canada method.
And you women, I'm sure you've picked this up already. There are more odd days in the month than even days. So actually, you're ahead of them. But guys, give that to them. Because it's worth it for the peace of quiet. And you know, I've been trying to teach that not just in relationships in marriage, but also in governments too. Liberal Party, Conservatives and Labour Party here. Instead of arguing and wasting all your money in Parliament, arguing with each other, why don't we have it so that the Labour Party is right on the even days of the month and the Tory Party is right on the odd days of the month? Then there means there's no argument. They get much more work than when they're arguing with each other. Do you think that would work for a happy democracy? I don't know, but it certainly works for a marriage anyway. Because the harmony is more important than right and wrong. It has to be fair. So anyway, that's why I think people during marriage ceremonies. I tell them also that marriage is like a pack of playing cards. It starts off with two hearts and a diamond. Then it finishes off with a club and a stupid face. Why are you laughing, this? That's a terrible joke. Oh, the other joke about marriage, about Valentine's Day. This fellow in Australia, on the day before Valentine's Day, the 13th of February, happened. He said, darling, Valentine's Day tomorrow, is there anything you want? I want to give you something for Valentine's Day. And she said, darling, I don't need anything, I'll call you. But he'd been married long enough to know that's not what she meant. But come on, I want to give you something, a good present. So she looked at him and said, darling, anything with diamonds. He said, okay. So the next day, she opened up, comes out of Valentine's Day present. It was a pack of playing cards. It had 13 diamonds in it. It's much cheaper to go for the jewelry shop. But anyway, that's why the life game wants to go to the weddings. We tell jokes. But also some interesting stories as well. So anyway, whatever you're afraid of, you know, it's actually what usually comes up. And over the caring and the curiosity. This particular guy, I knew him when he was a very small boy, he just came to play in our monastery. There are sometimes kids, they come and they run around our temples and monasteries. That's why the kid who was there first of all, please don't come back again. Because when they get chucked out of a lecture or any event, they get negative towards us. Many of the kids played around in our temple, made a lot of noise, a lot of mess, but they came to feel that this was part of their home. So they grew up with us. When they're at school, they get into trouble at school, we get them out of trouble, give them some good advice at university. And this particular guy had known him since he was really tiny. And so when he came across a trauma in his life, and his trauma was that he graduated as a medical doctor, first year in hospital, the first time one of his patients died. It was tragic. It was a young woman, maybe in her mid-20s, and even though there's nothing wrong he did, you always feel that maybe somehow I could have done something more. He felt so guilty. And it was worse when he was the one who had to go and tell the husband of the woman you've chosen in your life, the one you still love so much. She's dead. And to add even more pain, he had to say that their two young children had no mother. She was dead. Now I can't convey the pain that actually is when you can tell someone that terrible, terrible news. It's devastating. I mean, devastating in the extreme to a man with a family, young family, to hear that. All the dreams, the hopes, the happiness just crushed.
with what Peter gives. And this young doctor said, I can't do that ever again. And that was so hurtful for me to see the pain which I had caused this man, that I have to choose another career. All that effort, that study, he was willing to give up because he couldn't face such an experience ever again. And that's actually what I told him. That in any caring profession, doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists, nurses, whatever, in any of those professions, please understand, as a doctor in particular, that your purpose is not to cure people. If you think that that's your purpose, you will fail many, many times in your career. You can't always keep people alive. No one can. You'll fail. But if you understand that your main purpose in life as a doctor is not to cure people, but to care for them, you never, ever need to fail. You can't always cure people, but you can always care for them. And means you never need to be a failure. And if a person does die, if they and their family know they've been cared for so much, it takes away not all of the pain, but a lot of the pain of the death. And if you make caring more important than curing, you'll also discover that more of your patients will survive. Care is one of the most powerful of therapies. And so he took it on straight away, and he understood it, went back to work, practiced it. Many, many years later, he's a specialist, and the law of karma, how it works. One of my monks had bleeding from his anus, stool was running for weeks. Most times, the monk would just let it go. This will go away by itself, just relax. But this was so bad. Went to see the doctor. The doctor said immediately, you should have come to me weeks ago with this. This could be bowel cancer. I'm going to send you to get an endoscopy as soon as possible. Just like National Health Service, the government medical care in Australia is good, we have to wait. When they say it'll take about a month to get an appointment, he said, no, you can't wait that long. Go find it. They went private, and the doctor we got, who was performing the endoscopy, was that young man I talked about here. So, no fees paid, all done for free. I helped him stay as a doctor, changed his attitude to his career, and this was part of the payback, which was very beautiful. I love when things like that happen. What you do, kindness comes back to you. But that curing is what causes so many problems in life. Going back to your father, saying, the old guy, all the things wrong with you, are you going to try and cure those? Take it from me, take it from anyone who's been mad for a long time, you can't cure your man from all his bad habits. If you do, they get worse. You can't cure your wife, your female partner, and her bad habits either. It does not work. But you can care for them. You can always care for your partner and care for your wife. And you find that if you care for them, then their bad habits start to disappear and fade. This is incredible therapy which actually works. Recently I was reading about the Finnish system for dealing with schizophrenia. And I was so impressed that some of these ideas are actually getting mainstream. Instead of trying to cure the schizophrenia, the Finnish system was actually caring for people with schizophrenia. Not trying to cure them anymore. Respecting everybody, no matter how they view the world. And that had huge results, better than other treatments. And so keep on going in that area. You're actually going in this area of medicine and the psychology where people feel rejected, stigmatized, not good enough, a failure, a disappointment, a problem. And that makes those behavior much more antisocial, much more problem for other people. It's a curing instead of caring. So with that background, now we go back to the main subject of inner fear. If you try and cure inner fear, get rid of it, you're actually being afraid of fear, you're just amplifying it. What we call in Buddhism double suffering. You're suffering and you're suffering because you're suffering. You're afraid of your pain. It just grows. And instead we find the other way. We care for our fear. Ah, poor little mind, you're afraid. That's okay. When you care for it, you undermine this controlling, which makes it much, much worse. You care for yourself. So what are you afraid of? Some people are afraid of what other people might think of you, which is one of the stupidest of fears. Because I read this and I understood this straight away. It was the story that when you're maybe from about 15 to about 25 or 30, when you're in that young age, you are so concerned with what other people think of you. You're concerned about your image, your looks, the way you dress, the way you speak. You're looking for a partner in life. You're looking for success in your career. And you're really so concerned what other people think of you. Once you sort of know you have a stable relationship, a stable career, you get this what they call confidence. You basically don't even doubt what other people think of you, you just do it anyway. That becomes the middle age, sense of confidence. But then when you get to my age, you finally discover that people weren't thinking about you anyway. They're only thinking about themselves. And that's so true. In this university, a young man, you see a pretty girl, and you go and try and talk to her. I wasn't born a monk. I'd go and try and talk to her, and I'd be so afraid of what she thought of me. And it's only later on I found out that these women, these girls, which I went out with, when I was going to walk up to them, they were so concerned. What's he going to think about me? They're so concerned with one another. And for goodness sake, stop worrying what other people think of you. No one is really thinking of themselves all the time. Most of the time, not thinking about you. It's how do I come across? That's what I was worried about. She was worried. How do I come across? So please relax. And don't worry what other people think of you. A lot of times, that why other people think of you, that causes so many psychological problems. Even just on this subject, that's how to take Buddhism and this amazing sort of psychology and wisdom and bring it into the real world. Already mentioned about young men and young women. What are young men and young women most concerned about is finding a partner in life? And one thing I was never taught at university or by my parents, what I need to do to get a partner. Should I be better food? Should I have be tough? Should I be like Sylvester Stallone and sexy? Should I have expensive clothes? And so when I had a youth seminar for 15 to 25 year old Buddhists, what I did was I separated male and female, and then I said to the girls, what do you like in a guy? Now what turns you on? What attracts you? What are you looking for which makes a guy attractive? You know, all the guys were finally paying attention because they didn't know, they never thought of this before. You know, you get taught how to drive a car, you're taught how to do your career, that one tells you what the opposite gender wants. And many men go through their whole life not knowing what I should do. What's wrong with the relationship? Why is it going wrong? You're never told. And all these women, they came along and they said, we want the guy. It doesn't really matter, it doesn't have to be tough. doesn't have to look at any wrong word thing. That was important. Also has to be trustworthy. So if he says he's going to be there at a certain time, he has to be there. At least let me know. Give me an SMS or something. It's been called a traffic jam or something. Trustworthy. And it's always really important. Happy. Smiling. And kind. And kindness is really important for them. You don't have to look like a brain pit to be kind. It's something you can learn and change.
Guys, what would you like in a girl?
What would you tell children? What type of girl would you like to go out with? Does she have to be drop-dead gorgeous? The guy said, put it out, it's not that important. He said, you don't need to wear expensive clothes. What I like in a girl is boys. They came to this conclusion. I want someone who's kind, who's trustworthy, and who comes on time. If they say they're going to call a certain time, they actually do call around that time. And who's fun to be with. And who's kind. And that came out so strongly. And I only wish I had known that when I was that age. Because then I may not become a monk.
No, I'm very happy to be a monk.
But this is, you're going out into the body with a person. A kind and fun, relaxed, trustworthy thing that was so important. So once we know those things, once we know the rules, it makes life so much more easy. We don't want to impress a person. You know, girls and boys suss that out pretty quickly. You're just playing a game. You're not really who you really are underneath. But also someone who's confident, which means you're not ruled by fear. That is also confidence. It's one of the great attributes which makes you attractive. So where that confidence comes from, I don't care what people think of me. And I've been dressed like this for such a long time. And sometimes you wonder, you get sort of embarrassed, dressing like a girl. That's what this world looks like. Even here, in this hall here, go to the toilet. They don't actually say male and female, they've just got a stick figure on the toilet. If I just busted the stick figure, what do I look like? I would have gone to the girls. And even better than that, I was visiting Stoke-on-Trent. I've got family up there in the Midlands. And I was visiting them one day, and in the morning going for a walk before the lunch. And going for a walk, this has only happened to me once in my life, that people were pointing at me and laughing. Look at him. And it was just so over the top of my ears, I couldn't understand, you know, what people in the Midlands thought of me looking like this. I thought they were trying to humiliate me. I thought I was dressed as a girl was really funny. This is about 30, 40 years ago. Transgender was really rare in those days. Until I realized it wasn't because they thought I was dressed like a girl. We turned the corner and there's this big billboard, big signpost. Circus was in town. And they thought I was one of the crowds. Well, I didn't mind that. That's making people happy. But anyway, so when you know why other people think of you, then of course, a lot of fear of life goes. Fear of achieving. That drives many people to what they fear is success in academia, in life, at a great cost of sacrificing your happiness, peace, and not being relaxed, always being on edge, trying to succeed. And this is a story which happened to me here in Cambridge, changed my life. Because here I had time to contemplate. My brain was being well trained, so I had the means to contemplate, looking at what I was supposed to do in life, and looking also back on my career so far in school. When I was about to do my O-levels, I loved playing soccer in the park. I loved football. But you know what happened? My parents and my teachers said, stop chasing the ball, stay home, do your homework, pass your O-levels, and if you pass your O-levels, then you'll be happy in life. You've got a good solid foundation. And of course, I trusted these people, and I followed their advice. I did well in O-levels. Was I happy? No, more work, A-levels, even harder. They said, don't worry about this.
do your A levels, do well, and then you go to university. And that troubles chasing a football or chasing girls. Stop chasing girls, stay at home, do your homework. If you get your A levels, they're going to be happy, be successful. But follow their advice again. Did well at A levels, that's why I came to Cambridge. And they would say, I know it's hard work at Cambridge, but really try hard, because if you get a degree from Cambridge, then when you graduate, then you'll be happy. And it was at that time I started getting suspicious. Because I saw some people who'd already graduated. Were they happy? No way. They were working. They asked me, I asked them, are you happy? They said, no, no, no. But you're saving up enough money to get a car. When I get a car, then I'll be happy. So somebody already had a car. Said that when I find, they were going to find a partner in life. When I find the right girl and the right woman, then I'll be happy. And then some of them found a good partner. Were they happy? No, because then they needed a house. Whether they needed a house or an apartment, they were really expensive these days. But even then, they were hard to find. I work in a couple of jobs because when I get my house and with my wife, then they'll be happy. So before even they got the house and paid it off, then they had kids. Okay, so that delayed their happiness for another 20 years. They started thinking, now where's our kids? Where they grow up, get educated and leave home? Then we'll be free, then we can be happy. By that time, they're getting old, and they think, well, you know, a few more years of work, then when I retire, then we'll be happy. Save up enough, then we can travel the world, all the things which we've sacrificed so much for. And by the time they get to that age, you know what happens? That used to be the time when most people go to church, or they go to Buddhist society, or they turn to religion when they're old. You know why they go to church when they're old? If you go to any church in Cambridge, you find it's mostly old people. You know why? Because they think, if I go to church, you know, listen to all these boring sermons, all these empty rituals, I will do this because when I die, then I'll be happy. And there was something suspicious there. Why does everybody, when I do this and finish this, then I'll be happy? When it comes to Friday, finish work, then I'll be happy. When I finish school, then I'll be happy. When I find the love of my life, then I'll be happy. When the divorce is finalized, then I'll be happy. What is it? So we always put happiness a long way into the future, so we never actually reach it. When I was young, this is associated. When I was young, I always thought you had to be successful to be happy. And that was what I was describing. Later on, I found out from psychologists, no. If you're happy, then you're successful. And I found that's wrong too. Happiness is success. Anytime you're happy, congratulations, you are successful. So this idea of success, which drives you to sacrifice, stress out, ruin your health, ruin your life for some promise of happiness in the future, that really is terrible, and that also gives you a lot of fear. The fear of failure. When you come to this other form of happiness, or success rather, the happiness is success. Success is at your fingertips. Any time, you don't have to pass your exams to be happy. You don't have to be a billionaire to be happy. You don't have to be popular to be happy. All you need to do is be you and be happy. To understand the other thing, why I always say that everybody is good enough. My disciples in Singapore, they have a t-shirt. I am good enough t-shirt. I love t-shirts. Because there's a lot of difference in t-shirts these days. One of the best t-shirts I have seen is the first line says, nobody is perfect. You all know that before. The second line was, I am a nobody. The third line was, therefore, I am perfect. That makes a lot of sense to me. One of the other things, before I was going off to, I think it was the Malaysia once, that one of my friends tried a vain attempt to convert me to Christianity. So hopeless, but he should have done better than try to convert me. And so they talked to me, and they got serious, they were friendly, and they said, you know, I don't know. Nobody, although they said, not nobody, nothing is higher than God. I said, yes, I agree with you. Totally. Nothing. Emptiness. The void. Nirvana. It's much higher than God. He said, that is not what I mean. You be cheeky with me and I'll be cheeky back. Anyway, back to look, I'm good enough. What do I mean? I'll prove it to you that you are more than good enough. The next time you go into a wood here in England, beautiful forest in England, go for a walk in a wood, and please try and find for me a perfect tree. By which I mean one which is dead straight, with branches equally spaced, with only green leaves, no yellow leaves, no brown leaves, and no leaves which have been eaten by insects, with no broken off branches, and with no damage to the bark or to the trunk. See if you can find a tree like that. Then the place you'll find a tree like that is botanical gardens, where they're plastic trees. They're not real. They are pampered. They are namby-pamby, cream-puff trees. Not real ones. You go to a real forest, every tree is bent and crooked. Every tree has branches broken off. Every tree, especially this time of year, yellow and brown leaves and eaten leaves. There's animals living in there, the bark, the trunk is all damaged and marked and scarred. Every tree is like that. And in fact, your favourite tree in the forest is probably the one which is the most bent and crooked. With all these incredible, amazing sort of damaged parts on the trunk. And where the branches are broken off, the holes are where the birds make their nests. The most beautiful trees in the forest are the crooked, damaged ones. So if you are crooked and damaged, if you are bent and mottled, that you are not living up to what people expect of you, because they expect trees to be perfect, you know that you, with all your failings, and all your faults, all your mental diseases, other diseases, that you are a tree of the forest, number one, that you belong. And also, the more damaged goods you are, the more beautiful you become. My favourite trees in the forest are the most crooked ones. There's no such thing as damaged goods being rejected. They become the most beautiful trees in the forest. So you don't have any more inner fear about not succeeding. In fact, if you do succeed, you are not an interesting tree anymore. The most beautiful trees in the forest are the crooked ones. So if you've got a partner who's crooked and bent and so imperfect, congratulations. He or she is beautiful. Once you understand that, you understand why we're afraid of failure. We totally misunderstand what life is all about. It's not about succeeding to be happy. It's happy who you are. Bent, crooked, weird, strange, a monk who is fat, who's working, falling off, who tells stupid jokes, and you still come back again. You know, you've heard those jokes before. I don't know why people keep coming to this issue. I think it's because I'm relaxed. First time I'm here. Happy in my own skin. I'm a crooked tree. I've got damage on my back. But I'm happy to have that. That's who I am. Now, final story. Before we open up for questions. About fear. The inner fear, not being good enough. Some people have always said, it's easy to say to you as your brother,
that our fears are heard in my life. How do you know how to fear when your trust in other people has been destroyed? You've been hurt and damaged so much. Big time. Being raped, tortured. Because this is one of the stories I get a little bit emotional about because it's powerful, it works. Over in Australia, there's a local group, Australian Society of Survivors of Torture and Trauma. Refugees who managed to escape from some incredibly terrible places in the world, which existed right now, they've been tortured, demeaned, treated worse, dirt, multiple rape, beaten, electrocuted, tortured, maimed, and somehow or other physically they survived. Giving refugee status in a country like UK or Australia. Bodily they're free, emotionally, mentally, but still in those torture chambers. How the heck can we help them? For the minds to be free. Just bringing them to a country like this is not enough. The mind is still back there, wherever they witness and make this treatment. And the members of this society, they say, the things which work the most, they got from me. That's why it really interests me. Well, what exactly and how? And they say this was sort of things I've just been teaching here. The trees in the forest. But they've been damaged terribly. It's not your fault. You've been damaged terribly by your early history. You can become a beautiful tree in the forest. But even more than that, the wonderful reframing called opening the door of your heart. I keep going back to that story because it's one of the most powerful I've ever known, which helps so much. It was told to me by my father how this actually works in survivors of torture and trauma. As I asked them, when they're ready for it, it takes a lot of courage. But people realize, and you may realize, that this is the only way. You have to really befriend your fear and your memories. So I asked them to imagine a heart in your chest. Not a medical heart, but a heart you see on the Valentine's Day cards. That works the best. Easy to visualize in your chest. A big Valentine's Day heart. And then to imagine two doors in that heart. Open up. And then you are standing over the part of you which you think is good enough. The part which did pass its exams. The part which was successful, which was kind. The part of you which you have accepted and befriended. And then a staircase comes down from your heart. And on the ground is those yous which you have pushed out and rejected. The little girl who was beaten, the boy who was raped, boys get raped too, the person who was treated so inhumanely, the person who was hurt, almost, actually was almost unendurable. I'm surprised anyone could survive what went on, and it's going on right now in some of these places. Those little people are pushed out. Rejected, not good enough. And they're standing outside of you. And you, the one you like and accept, on top of the stairs, say, come up, come in. You are part of me. You are me. And you imagine these little people, you've obviously rejected and understandably kept out for such a long time. Terrified, shaking, walking up those stairs to the gate of the top of the embrace. You befriend that dark side of you, the bad side of you. The side you're not proud of, the side that you feel you hurt and treated so badly, that comes up to you. And the embrace of befriending every demon in your body, in your past. and also in your future. Come home, the door of my heart is open. It's incredible how what happens. A catharsis happens. The main problem which survivors of torture have faced is not embracing and coming to terms with, and even actually befriending what happened to them. And the catharsis is incredible to see. Now they can be free. The example I gave, us last night in a talk in London. One of these survivors was at my temple in Perth, in Australia, and when she told a friend what had happened to her, gave the usual response, "Oh, that's awful, that's terrible what happened to you." And she turned around and said, "No, you have no right to say that. This is who I am. And I've come to peace with this. I am free. I don't reject it anymore. I'm not ashamed of it. I'm not afraid of it." She was free. You get so incredible just the person could do that. And so inspiring. So when we say defending fear, defending anything which happened to you, fear negative what happened in the past, defending guilt, anger, defending it. Allow it to come into your heart and then it transforms. It disappears. It becomes part of you, but the pain, the worst part of it. In Buddhism, they say the 2 hours. They could have called it the physical hour and mental hour. Physical hour also meant it happened to you. You can't get rid of that. You can't undo it. You can't get Dr. Who to go in a time machine and undo it. It's done. But you take off the mental hour. I don't want this. I don't like this. It never happened. Then when you take that off, 95% of the problem is gone. The other 5% of the problem, I told this last 2 years when I was here, I'm going to finish off with this. The last part of the problem, I call it the shit of life. Sometimes life really does give you a lot of shit. Worse, dog shit. Anyone who gets upset at me using such language, because I'm a monk, I really got so upset at vicars being so polite, so out of touch with ordinary people. You use that word, so I use that word. The Buddha said, monks, nuns, you should teach in the local language. This is UK. Use the word dog shit, then I can. So this is the final story, one of my favourites. Life sometimes you tread in the dog shit. And stupid people wipe them off their shoes. Wise people never wipe it off their shoes until they get home. And then they wipe off the dog shit under the apple tree, under the roses, under any garden. Because if you wipe it off under the apple tree, you will find 1 year later, your apples are sweeter and juicier than ever before. You know why? Dog shit. But the most important part of this simile is when you eat the apple, always remember what you are really eating. Transformed into delicious sweet apple. That's the trauma part. So-called failures, the so-called crookedness of the trees, the things you're afraid of, failure, not being good enough. No, those are the things, the dog shit of your life, that's what makes the apple sweet. So that lady who'd been tortured, terrible, she turned that into the dog shit into apples. Amazing woman. And that's what you do. So then you know you have a way of overcoming any problem, which means you'll never need to be afraid ever again. Not rejected. Classic Buddhist teachings. Da da da. So that's enough for me. Now is the time for interrogation. Q&A. Oh, you're very fast over there.
association with the astronomical chart, and they were a bit of a fan. They said, yeah, there's some ordinary people that can have some influences in them, but they say most people, when you develop, you can overcome those influences by what you do. Because once it was my birthday, 7th August is my birthday, on one birthday, people wanted, what can you get a monk who wants nothing? And so it's very hard to get a birthday present for a monk. And so this person came along and said, here's your birthday present. They read out my horoscope for the year. This was for people born on August the 7th in that year. And he read out the horoscope and it began with, for those born on this day, that this year will be a wonderful year for romance. And he never got any further, he was all cracking up laughing, and he was wrong. I'm still a monk.
For us, we love it, like the traits of human beings, and the age of human beings, traits, like you said earlier, that we need, you're a real,
that
you are. I am, actually. There's no imagination, there's enough to be, you know, to put those things in, to be stuff like this.
Yes. I understand that, and there's some truth to that, because now, one of the reasons I mentioned here why I'm here is really supportive, sort of the nuns. I did a lot to try and re-establish that in Buddhism. I am not being revolutionary, this is going back to tradition. In the time of the Buddha, there were lots of Buddhist nuns, Buddhist monks, totally respected. We lost that. I'm not trying to be modern, I'm trying to be old-fashioned, big in the back again. Only it happens to be modern as well. Someone has to do this, so I'm really putting all my effort into this. And so this is why I'm here, trying to raise awareness that there's no real place for someone like Chandra to stay here in the UK. There's no home for her. And for any other woman who wants to become a bikini, 20 or 30 pounds, it's different than me. Why is it that all the Buddhist leaders are monks? You think of any Buddhist leaders, even the Buddhist people who give talks in the Cambridge Buddhist Society, all men. There's something wrong there. So fix it. So, that's why I'm here. And the good news is that I have actually found a very suitable place for a nun's monastery here in the UK. Beautiful location, central London, only a couple of a mile or two from Victoria Station. Great grounds, for solitude, enough rooms there for a huge number of bikunis, ample parking. The only problem is the owner doesn't want to sell it. Queen Elizabeth, it's Buckingham Palace. Oh my God, the Queen's got so many palaces. She could spare one for a good cause. And anyway, she's getting old. She's over 90 now. It's about time she downsized. Like other people do. So that's being a leader. I don't want an ordinary place for the month. I want Buckingham Palace. That's my leader. Supervisor. Over some tests that you've been doing in your life. So there's nothing to it, but it's not.
So thank you for the question. Before we move on to the next question, we are also taking questions online via our Facebook page. So it's Cambridge University Buddhist Society. So if you're a bit shy to ask questions, we'll do alternate questions from the floor and from our Facebook page. So if you can just send a message or question, and we will just deal with the questions. And we would like to try to keep your questions short and sweet, so because we have a timing, this hall will start to close at 9:30. And so do feel questions, and I'll be reading them off Facebook directly. So if you have questions, you can just text the Facebook page. But first we'll take one from the floor.
And the questions don't have to be on the subject of the talk. I mean,
thank you so much for all that. Why do you think misogyny seems to pervade all religions?
Yes. I think it's control. Why do we control? Because we're afraid. We all know that the result of fear is control, over control. It's one of the reasons why people want to create fear. The fear of all of these refugees coming into the country, changing our culture. Fear causing extra control, extra surveillance, extra intrusion on things like the internet. Fear is the excuse. Life used to be so free when I was younger.
But why do you think men are so afraid of women?
A lot of times, when I was young, I was very afraid of gays and lesbians. I never understood them. I never knew any. There was a fear there. And of course, exposing yourself to the other, exposing yourself to a Muslim, getting to know the other, is one of the great ways of overcoming that misunderstanding which causes fear, which causes all things like misogyny, misanthropy, and Islamophobia. But one of the things which Britain used to be good at, but it's not so good now, that school used to be non-denominational, anyone could go to any school. The school I went to, you played soccer with a Muslim, with a Jamaican, with a Jew. I didn't care what religion they were, where they were from, as long as they were good on soccer, they were in my team. And that sort of, okay, it's called social engineering, but my goodness, I think it's about time that our Western democracies abolish religious schools, all of them, and have everyone together. So when we meet one another, we associate with one another, the fear of the other diminishes. I'm not sure about you, so I went to a single-sex school. One reason, no, I only had a brother, I didn't have a sister. I didn't understand where it really is. That is just very psychologically very damaging. We also are very pleased to hear from some of my followers in Germany that they don't have special schools anymore for those who are physically or mentally disabled. They are putting all these schools for two reasons. The ones who are mentally or physically disabled, they feel they're not excluded from society, they're not special, which means, you know, less than other people. And the other kids in the school, they associate, they see, they know that these people are part of a forest called humanity. They accept them much more, and it's far more understanding, which then causes less tribalism. Tribalism is increasing in this world. It's because we somehow don't know how to get on with each other. That's starting in many of our schools. So I think this is why we wonderful. It's hard task because there's so many vested interests in religious schools. And please, if you want to go to a church on a Sunday, if you want to go to a Buddhist ceremony any day of the week, but not just 24/7. So I think that's one of the reasons why the players don't get any single sex calls.
Alright, so the next question comes from Facebook. So what is the fine line, Hajan, what is the fine line between enjoying the present and pursuing hedonic pleasure?
If you pursue hedonic pleasure, you will never reach it. It's always up in the future. One of my similes is the donkey and the carrot. You all know the donkeys are stubborn, and you might beat them with a stick, but they will never do what you tell them to. So you tie the stick to the donkey's neck, a string on the end of the stick, and a carrot on the end of the string. The donkey sees a carrot here. So, desire, craving, moves the donkey towards the carrot. But of course, you know what happens. However fast you move, the carrot is always in front of you. That's pursuing hedonic pleasures. You'll find what you imagine to be true love, the
the best sex, the best pleasure.
You can almost get there. You always see it, but when you move towards it, it moves away from you. Satisfaction, fulfillment in life is within your grasp, but you can never reach it. And sometimes you find that your whole life is pursuing something more, and you die before you reach it. However, as a Buddhist, we understand how to catch the carrots of life. When you understand it's so simple, you've already been running out of the carrots of life, of what you think is fulfillment, success. You've been running out of the carrot all your life, so you don't need to run anymore, you just need to stop. Stand still. What happens to the carrot? As soon as you stop, just for momentum, the carrot spins further away from you. That's why when people start to meditate and think, what's this thing going on? Because what you're searching for goes further away from you. But then it goes further away until the carrot's 4 foot front of Tommy's mouth, then it starts swimming towards you, and it comes right up to your mouth. And the last thing you must always remember, compassion. So important, people forget compassion for last minute. Carrot, the door of my mouth is open to you. And that's how you catch a carrot, it's fine. Don't pursue them. Stop, and they will come to you. Try. Good exercise.
Sorry, but this is just a question about the friendly negative emissions in general. And I think, so from my personal experience, Cambridge was a very hectic place, like you always have a lot of stresses and difficulties. And I, myself, when I have tried to prevent certain things which happened over the summer, I have seemed to find this at the moment that they cause, that A, it's a lot of hard work trying to actively prevent something. But B, that it causes a lot of more emotional stress, which I don't, in some situations you may not be prepared for or may not be able to handle at that moment. So what do you make of the argument that there are points to potentially just like box or leave certain things to come back to them later?
Oh, yeah. No, no. Procrastination is always a wonderful thing. So you can procrastinate things, but never procrastinate. Never put on procrastination for anyone. Yeah, some things are not so important. There's other little saying which I mentioned last night, which is why it's fresh in my mind. There was a British Prime Minister called Harold Macmillan in the 60s. And in 1966, when he'd already retired, but he was still an elder statesman, and this was the time of what was called the Six-Day War, one of the biggest wars between Israel and all the surrounding nations. And during this war, this ex-Prime Minister was asked by the press, what do you think of the problem in the Middle East? And without any hesitation, Harold Macmillan replied, sir, there is no problem in the Middle East. Which, they dumbfounded the journalists. What do you mean there's no problem in the Middle East? There's a war going on, as we speak. Nations are struggling to survive. What do you mean there's no problem? And with great wisdom of somebody in high public office, he replied, sir, a problem is something with a solution. There is no solution in the Middle East, therefore it can't be a problem. And that is how you can do a lot of work without getting stressed. If there's something you can do, then it's a problem. If there's nothing you can do, and leave it alone. It's not a problem. Then you can put it off and see if there is something to do, then it's a problem. That's what I mean by procrastination, putting things off. But it's not a problem, because there's nothing you can do. That means you don't get stressed out, worrying and using your limited energy, worrying about things which you cannot make a difference to. There's nothing you can do. There's no solution. It's not a problem. You have to be more efficient the way you use your brain. Then you don't get stressed. It's not your work load, it's the efficiency. The other story, I've told this many times, this is, came from me, now I'm talking Harvard. How heavy is this bottle of water?
Don't try thinking grams and ounces. The longer I hold it, the heavier it feels. After 1 minute, my arm aches. 1.5 minutes, I'm in great pain. After 2 minutes, I'm in agony in a very stupid way. What should I do when it gets too heavy to hold comfortably? Also, put it down, rest. I just rest for a few seconds when I pick it up afterwards, it actually feels lighter. This is an example of what stress is all about and the antidote to stress. Once you get tired, your brain does not work efficiently. Whatever subject you're doing, you can't get the work done fast and high standard. You find you're writing some sort of essay or assignment because it takes such a long time, ideas don't come up because your brain has got no energy yet. What you should do, put it down, rest. Meditation is one of the most efficient ways of resting. When you come back to work afterwards, after resting, put it down at the bottle of water. Now your brain is charged, energized, you get 3 hours of work out of it. Because you're alive, smart. The problem with students is they work when they're tired. Instead of resting and then working to get the work done in less time. This is why Harvard calls it an investment of time. Relaxation. Not wasting time. You're actually making time by using your brain more efficiently. That's what it's talking about.
Thank you for the question. Okay, so one from Facebook right now. Yeah, John, how did you feel when you were expelled from the Thai Sangha by attending bhikkhunis? And did you feel remorse, pain, or fear? And how did you overcome that?
It wasn't from the Thai Sangha, it was only one small part of the Thai Sangha. And I thought, amazing, I fulfilled another one of my life goals, to be excommunicated, to be a rebel. And the nice thing about being excommunicated, you can only be excommunicated once. Now I'm free, I can do whatever I like. It's one of the things of not being bound by the authority of others. So I never felt remorse, I felt this is a wonderful blessing. Because now I can go back again. In original early Buddhism, every monastery was independent. We didn't have Hierarchies. We didn't have Mahanayakas. We didn't have Sangha Rajas. We didn't have Dalai Lamas. We had just monks and nuns, literally everyone equal in authority. People think democracy started in Greece. That is dubious. In the ancient scriptures of Buddhism, 2500 years ago, the democracy was a form which the Buddha thought to govern the Sangha. Every monastery, monastic community is independent, do whatever they like, their decisions hold, there is no hierarchy. Real pure democracy. And in fact, the Buddhist Sangha is the longest continuous democratic institution in our world. Even today, I have 20 monks. No, 19 months and 3 novices in my monastery right now, where we have a decision, I don't get my own way. And we have to take a vote, and I often get out of it. I'm proud of that. Even though I am many more years than anybody else in the ropes, we follow a democracy where any decision in a monastery is to take a vote. Even then, ordained bhikkhunis. I could not do it by myself. All the monks there, we voted on it. Should we do this? Has to be unanimous. If one monk says no, I could have gone ahead. That's a democratic tradition which I uphold, which I think is the future of Buddhism. Every monastery, totally independent. If you make a right decision, then it's possible. If you make a wrong decision, then you fall away. That's a natural evolutionary process of basically of life growth. Do the right thing, you grow. Do you have that natural hierarchy? The hierarchy is called the problem. It's wonderful to challenge that. This is something which has come up on Buddhism after the
time of the Buddha. Someone coming back to a pure form as an example of how human beings can act. Development, calm, cooperating with other people giving the respect to make their own decisions. So I feel this is a wonderful thing, a great privilege to be able to be excommunicated. What we thought was suffering, we find it actually beautiful. And that I simply remind you about Richard Walker, which I hope will be going to be teaching over the years. No. I don't think we're being prepared. So I made a form, first went to build a monastery in the West. No one trusted us, we know who we were, no money, so I had to learn how to build. Now, medical physicists here in Texas, just like and I didn't know how to make bricks and make concrete. Do the plumbing, I had to learn. Especially the main bricks. It was so easy, very difficult. Did my first brick wall, really careful. When it was finished, two bricks were finished. They were so crooked, they spoiled the whole wall. They gave me nightmares, wanted to destroy the wall, blow it up. And so much later, 6 months, for 3 months, so this guy came along, he saw that wall, he said, that's a beautiful wall, and said, are you blind? Can't you see the two bad bricks? He said, yeah, I can see the two bad bricks, but I can also see the 990 good bricks as well. For those months, I could not see my faults. I could not see the good bricks. I only saw faults. Faults. I could never see anything else. Every time I fell, I fell apart because of those two bad bricks I made. And when I told that, now I see the big picture. Every builder told me every bit that makes mistakes, it's called suffering of life. Every wall had two crooked bricks. But this builder told me in the industry, when we make a mistake like that, we tell our clients, the person who's paying for the house, is a thief. So we charge them a couple of £1,000. I thought, what a great ending to that story. The mistakes in the life, the crookedness, that's a feature, the suffering. Is transformed from dog shit into habits. So, where would life be without dog shit? Without fertilizer. The suffering is what fertilizes wisdom and compassion. That's a good thing.
So, one question. Actually, there are quite a few questions from Facebook, but this question is how to deal with difficult and toxic people.
How you deal with them very quickly is when you look at them, don't look at them through bad things. Every human being, this is my young man, I've got good in them, you've got a beautiful part in them. For me, I give the city of 1,000 petrolotus, but I notice it's closed on the outside, it feels very unpromising. It's dirty, it's hard, it's leathery, it's not got any colour, a closed lotus. But that lotus inside of it's got the most beautiful fragrant petals. Someone who's toxic, who is really hard to live with, if you can, if you've got no choice, you have to live with them or work with them, have a look for their beautiful part. It's in there somewhere. And when you see it, they see it, and that's what they show you back. It's amazing. Some people think this person is toxic.
and really half of it, that was a beautiful wife who loves this beautiful husband. How can this person love this? P-A-S-T-R-D. They do. They can see something in them. So why can't you? So we look at the beautiful part of the person who's in this trouble, and that's what it shows back. If we look at their toxic part, that's all we will ever see, that's all they'll ever show back. I've done this with Peter Charles, with my niece, when I was in business. That's incredible. Do you mean I'm not a Peter Charles? You're not, you're a person. Who's done a beautiful act. There's another part of it. And when they see that, that is the start of their journey back from that terrible of what they've done. You're not a murderer. You're a person who's done a murder. You're much bigger than that. There's another part of it. If you call it murderer, toxic, pedophile, terrorists, there are no such thing as terrorists. There's people who've done terrorist acts. They're much bigger than the thing which we judge them for. Some of you just see that, that's all we see, that's all it shows back.
So we have just one question from the floor, and that will be you're the lucky question, so that will be the last one for tonight.
You've got one from the high realms.
Thanks very much for your talk. I had a question about something that I've been finding hard to reconcile. So I agree completely with what you said, and that happiness is equivalent to a one and the same. But the thing in my life that stopped me from getting there is my day job. And my day job is to try and develop a YouTube channel. Where, for example, if I fail on a particular day, I feel really bad about things because it's another day where, you know, it's extending essentially the time by which a new treatment is developed by a day. So my question is really for people like me, which I'm sure there are many researchers in the university working on problems to try and make the world better. How do we deal with this sense of you know, this extreme fear of failure in the world where we, when we fail, we might call something back that can really change the world in a positive way.
Okay, you find that failure is the most important part of learning. I was, after I went here, I thought I wanted to do something good in the world, first of all, by being a teacher. Set my first math exam at high school, had to ask for advice. The teacher said, don't send exams too easy. If people all get 95%, 100%, the exam has no meaning. Don't make it too hard. Some people get only 30, 35%, and people will lose their motivation and think they can't do anything. Set the score at about 70%. Then your students will think, yeah, we can do math. But also, where the 30%, when they fail, that's where me as a teacher can learn their weaknesses. And those are the ones which I will address in the next lesson. Failure, mistakes, are actually where learning happens, where growth occurs. And I realise that it's not just in academia, that's in life. If you all score 100% in life, 95%, you're so successful, you learn absolutely nothing. If you're really a failure all the time, 50%, 40%, you get declared valuable. That's where you learn. That's where you grow. And in so many cases where experiments fail, that is where new insights happen. It's not going the way it should. Why? Have a look. You're discovering more. And sometimes you know where great discoveries are made, but they're always made by accidents. Then something goes wrong, and then you discover something new. There's where innovation happens as a result of failure. Something goes wrong, and you learn, and you grow, and you make things better. Recently, we had the anniversary of the Great Fire of London. Because of that Great Fire of London, disaster! Things went terribly wrong. That's where they could build the city as it is today. And also, the sewage system was built at that time.
without having all the land cleared, all the buildings, they couldn't put a proper sewage system in. It would cost too much, no one would allow the property to be damaged by big sewage system. But apparently that's where the sewage system in London was put in. So whenever there's disasters, mistakes, there's always the opportunity there. So never look at mistakes, real mistakes. Look at those opportunities. We see it as one. And great discoveries happen when things go wrong.
Thank you.
So please make more mistakes. I must confess, when I was a member of the Buddhist Society at Cambridge, and I came to every talk because I thought I had to, as a committee member, I'd often fall asleep during the talks. And Bernard at the back said sometimes he hosted the talk, being the MC, and he fell asleep as the MC. And I vowed at that time that if ever I give a talk, I would always make it interesting and fun, so you never have to fall asleep again at a talk by the Buddhist Society at the University of Cambridge. Thank you for keeping awake.
Thank you very much, on behalf of all of us. We would like now to present you with an
exhibition. The next time somebody comes to give the talk here, it can be a performance. Why not?